5 in the morning is the most horrible time, particularly when your body is still desperately trying to disentangle itself from half a bottle of whiskey. We dragged ourselves, cold, crabby, and aching, from our bunks. The noise of submachine gun fire from the main room turned out to be frying bacon, and we tried to revive ourselves with this while the grey morning light began to seep hideously up into the sky outside. I've never understood all this fuss people make about the dawn. I've seen a few, and they're never as good as the photographs, which have the additional advantage of being things you can look at when you're in the right frame of mind, which is usually about lunchtime. After a lot of sullen fumbling with boots and cameras, we eventually struggled out of the door at about 6:30 and trudged our way back out into the forest. Mark started to point out exciting rare birds to me almost immediately, and I told him to take a running jump. A great start to a day of virtually unremitting ornithology. Gaynor asked me to describe the scene as we walked into the forest, and I said that if she poked that microphone in front of me once more, I'd probably be sick over it. I quickly found that I was walking by myself. After a while, I had to admit that the forest wasn't that bad. Cold, wet and slippery, and continually trying to wrench my legs off at the knees with some bloody tangled root or other, but it also had a kind of fresh, glistening quality that wouldn't go away however much I glowered at it. Ron Tyndall had joined us this time, and was busy striding his way through the undergrowth in an appallingly robust and Scottish manner, but even this ceased to make my head ache after a while, as all the glistening began slowly to work a kind of soothing magic on me. Way ahead of us, half glimpsed through the misty trees, the blue-plaid windcheater moved silently like a wraith, following the busy clinking of Boss's bell. After a longish while of trudging, we caught up with Arab, who had stopped again on a narrow path and was squatting in the sodden grass. "There's a fairly recent dropping here," he said, holding up a soft, dark, mottled bead for our inspection. "It's got that white on it, which is uric acid, and it hasn't been washed off by the rain or dried out by the sun. That'll disappear in about a day, so this is definitely last night. This is just where we were, in fact, so I expect we just missed him." Great, I thought. We could have stayed out a little longer last night, and stayed in bed a lot longer this morning. But the early sun was beginning to glimmer through the trees, and there was a lot of fragile beauty business going on, where it glistened on tiny beaded dewdrops on the leaves, so I suppose that it wasn't altogether bad. In fact, there was so much glimmering and glistening and glittering and glinting going on, that I began to wonder why it was that so many words that describe what the sun does in the morning begin with the letters GL, and I mentioned this to Mark, who told me to take a running jump. Cheered by this little exchange, we set off again. We had hardly gone 5 yards when Arab, who had already gone 15, stopped again. He squatted down once more and pointed at some slight signs of digging in the earth. "There's a very fresh excavation," he said, "probably last night, digging for this orchid tuber. You can actually see the beak marks through the bottom here." I wondered if this was a good time to begin feeling a bit excited and optimistic about the outcome of the day's expedition. But when I did, it started to give me a headache, so I stopped. The damn bird was just stringing us along, and it would be another gloomy evening of sitting in the hut cleaning our lenses and trying to look on the bright side. At least there wouldn't be any whiskey this time, because we'd drunk it all. So we would be leaving Codfish the following day, clear-headed enough to know that we'd flown 12,000 miles to see a bird that hasn't turned up to see us. And all that remained was to fly 12,000 miles back again and try to find something to write about it. I must have done sillier things in my life, but I couldn't remember when. The next time Arab stopped, it was for a feather. "That's a kakapo feather that's dropped," he said, picking it lightly off the side of a bush. "Probably from around the breast by its being quite yellow." "It's quite downy, isn't it?" said Mark, taking it and twirling it between his fingers in the misty sunlight. "Do you think it was dropped recently?" he added hopefully. "Oh yes, it's reasonably fresh," said Arab. "So this is the closest we've got yet?" Arab shrugged. "Yes, I suppose it is," he said. "Doesn't mean we're going to find it, though. You can stand practically on top of one and not see it. Signs are that Kakapo is quite active in the early part of the night, just after we were here. And that's bad news, because there was rain during the night, so some of the scent has been washed away. There's plenty of scent around, but it's inconclusive. Still, you never know your luck." We trudged on. Perhaps there was a bit more of a spring in our step, but as half an hour passed, and then an hour, and as the sun gradually crept higher in the sky, Arab was once more a floating wraith far distant from us in the trees ahead, and then we lost him altogether. The spring had certainly dropped from our step. For a while we stumbled on, guided by the very faint sounds of Boss's bell, which was still borne to us on the light breeze sifting through the trees but then that too stopped, and we were lost. Ron was a little way ahead of us, still bounding with rumbustious Scottish gusto, but he too was now floundering for the right direction. We were clambering over a bank that was thickly covered with ferns and rotting tree trunks, and which led down into a wide, shallow gully in the middle of which Ron was standing, looking perplexedly around him. Gaynor lost her footing as she negotiated the muddy slope into the gully and slithered down it elegantly on her bottom. I got my camera strap caught in the only branch that didn't break off the moment you touched it. Mark stopped to help me disentangle myself. Ron had gone into bounding mode again and was hopping up the far side of the gully, calling out for Arab. "Can you see them?" Mark called out. A thought struck me. We were lost because Boss's bell had stopped ringing. The same thought obviously hit Mark simultaneously, and we both suddenly called out, "Have they got a Kakapo?" A call came back. Gaynor turned to us and shouted, "They've got a Kakapo!" Suddenly, we were all in rumbustious bounding mode. With much shouting and hallooing, we clambered and slithered our way hectically across the floor of the gully, hauled ourselves up the other side and down into the next gully, on the far side of which, sitting on a mossy bank in front of a steep slope, was a most peculiar tableau. It took me a moment or two to work out what it was that the scene so closely resembled, and when I realized, I stopped for a moment and then approached more circumspectly. It was like a Madonna and Child. Arab was sitting cross-legged on the mossy bank, his long, wet, grizzled beard flowing into his lap, and cradled in his arms, nuzzling gently into his beard, was a large, fat, bedraggled green parrot. Standing by them in quiet attendance, looking at them intently with his head cocked on one side, was Boss, still tightly muzzled. Duly hushed, we went up to them. Mark was making quiet groaning noises in the back of his throat. The bird was very quiet and quite still. It didn't appear to be alarmed, but then neither did it appear to be particularly aware of what was happening. The gaze of its large, black, expressionless eye was fixed somewhere in the middle distance. It was holding, lightly but firmly in its bill, the forefinger of Arab's right hand, down which a trickle of blood was flowing, and this seemed to have a calming effect on the bird. Gently, Arab tried to remove it, but the Kakapo liked it, and eventually Arab let it stay there. A little more blood flowed down Arab's hand, mingling with the rainwater with which everything was sodden. To my right, Mark was murmuring about what an honour it would be to be bitten by a Kakapo, which was a point of view I could scarcely understand, but I let it pass. We asked Arab where he'd found it. The dog found it, he said. Probably about 10 yards up this hill, I'd say, under that leaning tree. And when the dog got close, it broke and ran down just here, where I caught it. It's in good condition, though. You can tell that it's close to booming this year because of its spongy chest. That's good news. It means it's establishing itself well after being resettled. The Kakapo shifted itself very slightly in Arab's lap and pushed its face closer into his beard. Arab stroked its damp, ruffled feathers very gently. "It's a bit nervous," he said, "especially of noise, probably more than anything. He looks very bedraggled because of being wet. When Boss first caught up with him, he would have been in a dry roost up there, and probably at the noise of the bell or the dog going too close, the bird broke out and ran down the hill and was still going when I caught it. It's just gripping me a bit, and that's all. If you wanted to put the pressure on..." He shrugged. The Kakapo clearly had a very powerful bill. It looked like a great horn-plated tin opener welded to its face. "It's definitely not as relaxed as a lot of birds," muttered Arab. "A lot of birds are really relaxed when you've got them in the hand. I don't want to hold it for too long since it's wet and will get chilled through if the water penetrates to the skin. I think I'd better let it go now." We stood back, carefully. Arab leant forward with the bird, whose big, powerful claws stretched out and scrabbled for the ground even before it got there. At last it let go of Arab's finger, steadied its weight on the ground, put its head down, and scuttled off. That night in the warden's hut we jubilantly polished off the remaining beers and pored over the records of all the Kakapos that had been transferred to Codfish. Arab had made a note of the identity number of the bird, which had been fastened to its leg. 8-44263. Its name was Ralph. It had been transferred to Codfish Island from Pegasus Harbour, Stewart Island, almost exactly a year ago. "This is excellent news," exclaimed Ron. "This is really very, very good news indeed. If this kakapo is coming up to booming condition just a year after being relocated, it's the best indication we've had yet that the transfer program is working. You know that we didn't want you to come here and that we didn't want to track kakapos and risk disturbing them, but as it happens, well, this is very useful information and very encouraging indeed.